The Guardian.
Sport, and welcome to a very special edition of Andy's Altman Summer of Sport, The Guardian's Everything Apart from Football sportscast. This is our world-exclusive Olympics preview show. It is the only Olympics preview in any format or medium, print, audio, video, sculpture or ballet that is being done this year. And we are here live in Rio de Janeiro. Sorry, London. Not Rio. I'm always getting them mixed up. Also, one with a 700-metre high mountain with a massive statue of a cricket umpire signalling a wide. I assume they don't play cricket in Brazil. It is. We are definitely in London. But despite the devastating realisation that the Olympics is happening in the wrong hemisphere, the wrong continent and the wrong year, this is our Rio 2016 preview special. And joining me this week, comedian, athletics nuts and undisputable Nebuchadnezzar of quizzes, it's Paul Sinha. Hello, Paul.
Good morning, Andy.
Welcome to the Summer of Sport. How excited are you about the Olympics?
I'm excited enough to have taken the entire Olympics off. I've got no work whatsoever, no gigs, no recordings of the chase, no nothing. I'm spending the entire two and a bit weeks sat in my living room at home with a remote control flicking from BBC channel to BBC channel. I haven't quite worked out the timetable yet, but there's not going to be much sleep.
Right. Living the dream.
Absolutely living the dream.
And also joining us, released from the Guardian Sports Writing Bunker for the day. And as you listen to this, already in Brazil, we're recording this a week in advance. So you're speaking to us basically from the future. It's Owen Gibson.
Marty McFly style. Hello.
Hello. I mean, it's going to be quite different from London, I guess. I mean,
absolutely. In London, I was able to stay in my own bed for a start, which helped.
Yes,
I guess that Paul will see a lot more sporting action than I will, because I'll be spending a lot of time either stuck in traffic jams or desperately trying to get from one venue to another.
Right. And I mean, we're not legally allowed to mention football on this show, but you were at the World Cup in 2014.
I was indeed. Yeah.
How is Brazil as a sports journalist? How is it as a place to travel around?
It's challenging at times, but I mean, they got away with the World Cup, I think, sort of by the skin of their teeth at times. You know, you'd turn up to stadiums and there'd still be trailing wires and bits of scaffolding that didn't look entirely healthy, but they got away with it. And one of the reasons they got away with it, of course, was the friendliness, the welcome, you know, the people did get into it, even though they had these huge protests beforehand. And the fact that a lot of fans travelled from other South American countries really made it. I think the difference with the Olympics is going to be, obviously, Olympics doesn't stir the soul of most Brazilians in the same way as football
right.
does.
They're not as into archery as they are into
football. Funnily enough, no.
Surprising,
or Olympic sport in general, because they've generally not been as very successful at it, basically. So that's going to be one of the interesting things, is whether the local population really sort of take to it.
Okay, now before we get going, gentlemen, if you could just quickly whazz into these test tubes.
And you're going to freeze those samples and test them again in four years' time.
We've just got to make sure it's all above board these days. Thank you. Here are this week's Olympic headlines. Olympic Stadium track redesigned after scientists prove that athletes run clockwise in the Southern Hemisphere. Russian Olympic Committee deny any wrongdoing after freestyle swimmer Butyl-Konossi Delphine is disqualified from the Games after being found to be a bottlenose dolphin. Delphine, aged 14, who grew up near Sochi in the Black Sea, claimed he was innocent.
I was only doing what my coaches told me to do. Can I have herring, please? I love herring.
And after concerns were expressed in the British lefty gossip rag The Guardian about the declining number of cities interested in hosting future Olympics that don't come with a despot or some highly dubious ethics attached, the IOC is reportedly investigating the possibility of holding the 2024 Olympics via Skype.
Athletics.
Well, you're probably the biggest athletics fan I know.
And I imagine so, yeah.
Olympic athletics has that rarest of sporting rarity in that it's once every 4 years, and it is basically the thing that athletes are defined by.
It very much is, and it's very much what I'm defined by as a sports fan as well, because at least 15 of the 25 times I've cried at sport have been performances in track and field athletics. Going back,
how many of those were your own performances?
None of them were my own performances. I don't think I've ever screamed as loudly as when Kelly Holmes was going down the home straight in the 800 back in Athens, and until 5 days later when the men's 4x100 got that incredible, unexpected gold medal. Track and field brings out the respectable patriot in me, in which I am absolutely, unconditionally, 110% proud to be British by living my life vicariously through the triumphs of people I've never met and will never meet.
That's what being British is all about.
Absolutely. And yeah. And hopefully there'll be some surprises this year as well. The Laura Muir thing, for instance, got you know, sent a shiver down my spine. I love it when British athletes come from relatively nowhere to launch themselves into world class. I'll never forget watching Dean Macy win the decathlon's 400 in 99 in the Worlds. Go, where on earth did this guy come from, and what is his story? And there will be surprises.
I mean, I think the interesting thing about track and field as well is obviously that, you know, kind of I've spent most of the last 2 years writing about doping and, you know, depressing scandals at the IAAF and so on. But even in the midst of that, when I went out to Beijing last year for the World Championships, you get a performance like a Daphne Schippers, or you get a moment like Bolt v Gatlin, and all of that is forgotten for that kind of 15, yes, 20 seconds. Obviously, afterwards, all the questions come back and so on. But, you know, kind of, again, at the anniversary games the other night, you know, kind of Laura Muir, or when the 100 metres women's hurdles record was broken and so on, that it retains a sort of unique ability as a sport just to make everyone stop and focus on that section of track for that sort of 20, 30, 3 minutes of time.
This is an interesting fact I found about athletics. The full start time, and it's always... I remember seeing some heats in London. I went to a lot of events in London. I spent a stupid amount of money on it, and very much like the event itself. and so you sort of see athletes who obviously have trained their entire lives and then full starting and not even getting to run. And it's 0.1 seconds, isn't it, the reaction? I found an interesting fact. Do you know what that is based on, how they calculated that?
No.
And so it's the fastest possible conscious reaction time, and they worked that out based on the average time in London between a traffic light turning green and you being honked by the car behind for not moving quickly enough. So that's...
scientifically done, yeah, on that basis.
Now, you mentioned Bolt v Gatlin at the World Championships. Obviously, you there. I don't know if you saw Steve Cram's commentary on it.
Obviously, heard it afterwards, yeah, and the fuss. But I mean, it was incredible because we were all sort of sitting there in the press tribunes. Obviously, kind of, we'd been writing about Gatlin. Had he been, you know, had he been almost too harshly treated, and were we building Bolt up too much? Then you look to your right, and the entire BBC crew is going absolutely berserk, jumping up and down at the fact that Bolt's won. It's like, maybe a bit more balance here might be required.
But no balance. It's the most clear-cut good versus evil since Rocky and Ivan Drago back in the 80s. There's a clear good and a clear evil there. Yeah. And that's what makes it such a great event, of course. I mean, everyone's looking forward to Bolt.
But where is Steve Cram going to go this year if Bolt beats Gatlin again? Is it going to be, he's, you know, not just he might just have saved his, but he might just have saved his species and his planet?
He might rise into a test tube in excitement. Yeah.
Who do you think is going to win? Because I saw Bolt last Friday in the 200, at the Olympic Stadium. I mean, looked kind of okay, but not.
But he always does this. Yeah. He always does this before an Olympics or Worlds, where he gets injured. Everyone, you know, kind of writes him off. I remember Daily Mail back page headline before the London Olympics, where he's sort of flat on his back in a stretcher, and then he'll perform pretty disappointingly at the warm-up events and then pull it out on the big occasion. And that, you know, that tends to be what he does. I mean, but what, at some stage he's going to come unstuck, isn't he? And, you know, you just, my fear, my sort of gut fear is that kind of with everything else that's around, about the gloom and doom around Russian doping and so on, that this will be the time that the Gatlin bests him, you know.
Well, to be fair, Gatlin froze last
year. He did, yeah.
If Gatlin had run his race last year, we wouldn't have the big, happy Bolt success story.
That's true.
And he's not going to freeze every time, unless his name's Asifah Powell. he's not going to freeze every time. And that's my worry. It's 8 years since Beijing. He's not the athlete he was. And eventually, rather like Ed Moses had to lose eventually, I think Usain Bolt has to lose. I mean, as you say, he does it every time. We won't know until the final. But one of the great things is is the psychological games they play. I mean, one of the great joys for me of watching 100 metres heats is watching the guy from Papua New Guinea finish 5 seconds after Usain Bolt jogging.
After stopping for a cigarette halfway up.
I mean, we're not going to know anything until this, even at the semi-final stage. It's unlikely we're going to know that much about what form they're in.
True, but I mean, but not only kind of athletics is relying on Bolt. I mean, in some ways, the whole Olympics is relying on Bolt again to sort of to pull it out of the bag. He's such a sort of towering figure.
I think it's the greatest sporting event there is, that Olympic 100 metres final. I just love that. I went to London, the most I've ever spent on a sports ticket. There's that intensity of, you feel the whole world is watching this, and you think it's 10 seconds every 4 years, and it's glorious.
It's extraordinary.
Foul joke on a miss. Andy Zaltzman 1, Sport 4.
What other events, Paul, are you looking forward to in track and field?
Well, obviously the heptathlon. I mean, that shines out like a beacon, because absolutely anything can happen. I did not expect Katrina Johnson-Thompson to fluff her lines at the long jump last year. And the question is, has that left lasting damage, lasting psychological damage? The evidence suggests not, given how gleefully she jumped 680 at the anniversary games. The evidence
but the suggests, anniversary games are very different to a to an Olympics. Now, you know, KJD it definitely is psychological.
She's the most naturally gifted athlete we've got, given that she holds British records in the high jump. The one year she was Britain's best in the high jump and the long jump and the heptathlon. She's clearly got the talents, but you imagine if psychologically it doesn't happen for her this year, that it may never happen for her. Whereas Jessica Ennis, it's happened and more again and again and again.
And again, she's the ultimate sort of big time performer. She always pulls out the bag on the big occasions.
So. And the only question mark over Ennis at the moment is that she fluffed her long jump lines at the anniversary games, unusually, but she's clearly in shape, because she ran 12.76 in the 100 hurdles. 12.76 is more than enough for her. You know, she overperformed last time with 12.54 in London. Massively looking forward to that. I mean, I'm looking forward to all of it, to be honest with you. And Mo Farah as well, who, of course, has never got the accolades he deserves.
He's got quite a lot of accolades, hasn't he?
Well, no. The fact that he's never finished more than third.
There's a curious thing in sports personality whereby he never... Yeah, you're right. He never finished more than third. And there's been, in between this game and the last one, there's been all the Alberto Salazar stuff again, you know, sort of doping whispers and so on, which, you know, kind of, I think, sort of plays into this sense that he's kind of respected rather than loved sometimes by the British public. But you're right, I mean, the scale of his achievements demand, you know, that he should be venerated.
And all logic says that an African's going to come along who's going to run the race out of Farah, but nobody wants to do that. He's benefited from the fact that 5,000 to 10,000 metre racing at the highest level is slow.
Yeah,
it's slow.
No one's ever sort of taken him on in the big championships, and you know, kind of, you'd think that at some point someone would tweak and they'd have a go. But is it extraordinary how he keeps, you know, basically working alone or with one other at best, he's able to hold off these Kenyans and Ethiopians? And you know, kind of, again, as with Bolt, at one stage his kind of, you know, logic dictates that his luck will run out. But you know, I think he's going to do both again this time around.
Certainly his recent 1500 metre run was impressive enough to suggest that he's in the right shape.
I mean, Caster Semenya is going to be fascinating. She's definitely doing the 800. She'll probably do the 400 as well. Fastest times in the world this year in both. That's going to, again, be a huge controversy. There was this CAS ruling, basically, that allowed her to compete, you know, kind of without any impediment. And so I think, you know, if she wins both, there is, again, going to be, as there was in Berlin, there's going to be this huge debate about her.
How difficult is that as a story to write about?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult because, you know, kind of, there's all kinds of ethical considerations to take into play. I mean, on the one hand, you're kind of, you know, your sense that she should absolutely be allowed to run rubs up against kind of, you know, some of the complex medical data. I mean, I know colleagues that were in Berlin found it incredibly difficult particularly because it was all new to them then. You know, there was no... She'd come out of nowhere, effectively. I mean, at least now we've got a background that are kind of a sense of what the arguments are and what the arguments are on both sides. But this CAS ruling came slightly out of left field. No one really expected them to just kind of sweep away everything they'd gone before. And so I think it will be interesting to see how that's responded to. And it'll be interesting to see the sort of the range of opinion on that. Christian Taylor, funny enough, in the triple jump, I'm really looking forward to as well.
Yeah. So, that could be, it's a potential world record.
Again, you know, he wasn't that far away in Beijing, and you know, that's one of those records that people look at and think, is that ever going to be broken? The Jonathan Edwards one, and you know, he's very close to it. And there's something I really like the triple jump as an event. I mean, kind of, you know, again, when they get it absolutely right, it's almost like they're floating across that track.
Yes. Just one other athletics line coming in on the wires. The Spanish Athletic Federation have complained to the IOC after the IAAF ruled that they're not allowed to release a bull onto the track behind their runners to chivvy them along. The spokesman said, "It's part of our culture. We've trained the bulls only to run in our lanes. I'd be really angry about this if it wasn't 3 p.m. and I wasn't in the middle of my afternoon snooze."
Andy Zaltzman, Summer of Sport.
Time now for a look back into the Olympic archives and great moments in Olympic history. We go back to the London Games of 1908.
Gerald, thank you, yes. Welcome to Southampton Water and here in the Class A motorboat race. First time it's been held in the Olympics, of course, just coming to an end now. And yes, there it is, gold for France. I'm deeply sorry to report the one finisher out of the two boats that began isn't sport great. 2.5 hours of quite riveting action, watching for the most part one boat go round some distance away. I preferred yesterday's race, it didn't even finish. It was shorter, at least two British boats, no one else, and we still couldn't get a bloody medal. Bloody weather. Britain beating Britain, I suppose you could say. But anyway, re-race today, Gerald, and some Frenchman turns up, says, "Bonjour, la mer," and our British boat, the Wolseley Sidley, driven by the Duke of Sodding Westminster of all people, hits a bloody sandbank or something and gets stuck, leaving the water open for La France, the boat Camille, as I believe she is ever so Frenchly benamed, driven by some chap presumably called Emile. Derek, can you check that for me? Is it Derek? Can you check the press pack? Is it Emile?
Tony, it's a 47-year-old guy called Ernest from Durham. He's racing in a French boat, therefore, for France.
What? Well, I'm going to call him Emile. Au revoir, Emile, you bloody onion-wearing traitor. Waltz off back to Paris with your medal de gold, or whatever you people call it. He'll probably try to help himself to the silver and the bronze, too, I wouldn't wonder. Cheeky little... Anyway, they are getting very excited in the commentary box next door, I can... Ah, oui, oui, tout droit! Le gagné de médaille d'or pour la France! Vive la France! Mais voyons la dure des crises motorisées! Tout droit, champion! 2h26 minutes et 53 secondes! Nouveau record olympique! Nouveau record olympique! Tout droit, le grand gagnant, tenez la l'Angleterre! Allez la France! Il a vaincu le duc de Westminster! Tout droit! Fichez la page, ou les pigdogs! So, yes, in summary, Gerald, a very bad day for Team GB here at Southampton Water. And I'm joined now by the defeated man, the Duke of Westminster. Duke, you just lost a two-boat race to a pretend Frenchman. You must be disappointed.
Yes, Tony, absolutely gutted, but there are a lot of positives to take away and build on. I gave it 110%. I left everything out there.
Including the boat?
Yes, including the boat.
Aiming at the bloody sea next time, you loser. Gerald, back to you in the studio.
Strap in, it's Andy Zaltzman, Summer of Sport.
Owen, on your roster of events, do you have to cover the 50-kilometre walk?
Luckily for me, no. I think that hopefully will be delegated to somebody else. I mean, race walking is not a sport, is it, at the best of times? And as a sport, it's been completely decimated. But I mean, the interesting thing about the race walking this time actually is that there are going to be no Russians. The Russians, funnily enough, have completely dominated race walking in recent years, and we know why. They're obviously not going to be there this time.
You say we know why, but what I want to know is who looked at race walking and thought, we need to win this for the purposes of national glory? How can you possibly think anyone... Russians are going to be sitting at home thinking, I feel so much better about the injustices of the Putin regime because we've got a gold in the 50-kilometre
walk. A medal is a medal.
They all count on the old medal table, so...
Yeah, it's the overall table, I think, that we're talking about here. But yeah. Then Britain did beat Russia, didn't they, in 2012?
On gold medals, but not on overall medals.
Well, this was another topic I wanted to bring up. The Olympic medals table always annoys me because of the way it's done. That's, you know, say two golds... no silvers, no bronzes, beats one gold, 500 silvers and 1,000 bronzes. That can't be right.
It's ridiculous.
It's an injustice.
It should be a points basis, shouldn't it? It should be 5-3-1, depending on, or something like that. Because, and actually there is no, the IOC always make this point, there is no official medal table. Yeah. It's basically a construct of the media, because, you know, obviously we need a means by which to kind of crow about how well or badly we're doing. No, I agree with you that it shouldn't be purely gold medals, because that clearly is ridiculous.
Could it not be done on a points table of 3-2-1 or 5-2-1 or something like that?
Yeah, sort of 5-3-1.
But then also you have another level of injustice where some sports, like a lot of the sports I enjoyed most as a spectator in London, things like water polo and handball, which were fantastic, and because we don't have a medal chance, we just totally ignore them as sports, which I think is a real shame. Because, and same with basketball as well. These are sports I think could make a big difference to our national fitness, this kind of vague idea of a sporting legacy. But, you know, one gold for that, and it's 2 weeks of competition.
Swimming, it's just a different
number of people all going 2,000 metres backwards.
Which is the kind of, again, and if you look at where countries put their resources, it tends to be in those, in events where they think they've got the best chance of winning medals, or B, where there's the most medals available. And you get this kind of, you do get this slightly unintended consequence, you say, of focusing all your money on where the medal chances are. So
we are very, very good at that.
So, for example, obviously all the sitting down sports that we're very good at, cycling, rowing, sailing, have this sort of virtuous circle where the better they do, the more money they get. And something like basketball will obviously get nothing because they've got no chance of winning that medal.
Kieran and sprint is the one that gets me. They're essentially the same event, aren't they? They involve driving, that shows how much attention I pay. They involve cycling very, very slowly and then suddenly going into a sprint. Except one, you're up against one opponent, and the other, you've got a man.
Say the 100 and 200 metres, they're basically both just running very fast. But
yeah. Well, the Kieran is a curious event, for those who aren't familiar with it. It's probably one of the Olympics' silliest events, where a bunch of cyclists pursue a lone motorcyclist. But it is one of the rare Olympic sporting disciplines that has practical everyday application. For example, we need to chase down a pizza delivery boy who's utterly failed to include the extra jalapenos on your 15-inch deep pan Mexican mayhem. Or you want to ask a police outrider to pass on a goodwill message, ransom demand, or smutty joke to the Queen in a royal motorcade. So there are, you know, it has a practical.
You had a Kieran joke all prepared. That's
brilliant, Andy. It's not many comedians bring that to the game.
And you do get this curious mix as well at Olympics, where obviously you're sent along to do various events. You know, obviously cycling, I've got a reasonable knowledge, but you'll get sent along to the handball or the taekwondo or the Greco-Roman wrestling or whatever, and I've absolutely no clue really what is going on for the majority of the time. But there must be one guy there from from World Taekwondo News has been waiting for this moment, and he's besieged by about 30 other gentlemen looking over his shoulder and poking him and saying, what happened there? And the worst example of that I can remember was curling at the Sochi 2014 Games, obviously, where we all pitch up once every 4 years and try and work out what the hell is going on in the curling. And there's a guy from the Glasgow Herald, I think, again, who kind of, you know, is a specialist curling writer who spent his whole time tutting and being very gracious with the rest of us, you know, explaining what on earth is going on.
Repeat after me, I do solemnly swear by almighty sport to watch the sport, the whole sport, and nothing but the sport. So help me, sport.
Open water swimming, I didn't go to see that live. But on the subject of race walking, I found my sporting limit there when I had a ticket to watch the 50-kilometre race walk. I think it was the last Saturday of the games, and
that,
I woke.
You were able to calibrate exactly where your tolerance level was.
I'd never found a sporting tolerance level before, and I woke up that morning and thought, no.
I did go to the open water swimming. Again, that is one of the events where really you can't really tell what's going on for most of it, because you've basically got grandstands on the serpentine in front of the finishing line. You see them all jump in, head off up the serpentine, come back again. And unless you're watching the big screens, obviously it's very hard to tell what's going on.
But it's quite good on telly, though.
It is. It's kind of scrapped as well when they're getting in there.
Really.
On that subject, be honest. Can you tell a good dive from a bad dive?
What, splash, isn't
it? It's all about splash. It's all about the splash.
But apart from assuming that the splash given at the highest level is pretty solid for all the contestants.
No, you'll see a differential in splash, definitely. You know, kind of, it's all about the water entry.
Are you going to be doing weightlifting? Because that surprised me as a spectator sport. I really enjoyed weightlifting because it's an odd mix of tactical intricacy and narrative drama. But basically all it involves is... it starts at the lowest weights with people the size of Sue Barker lifting the equivalent of three Sue Barkers.
Which is the most extraordinary of once you get up to the huge guys lifting huge weights, that's a bit more like, well, you can see how you could do that. But when you're sort of at Zoe Smith level, it's kind of extraordinary to see these sort of tiny women hoisting.
But at least you know
weights.
When you're watching weightlifting that it's a sport completely untainted by drugs.
Absolutely. We can be sure that is true.
That's the important part.
Well, so reading about the 2012 gold medalist in the 105 kilogram plus, which is the biggest category in men's weightlifting, Behdad Salimi of Iran. And he's a man who could pick up a large gorilla, hold it above his head for a few seconds, particularly if that gorilla was in two halves on either end of a metal bar, but which is a good skill to have.
Yeah.
Good skill to have. So we're 4 years on from London's famous Danny Boyle opening ceremony, which there were a few things I was very uncomfortable with. For example, the Queen being in a helicopter with James Bond for 15... I mean, we know what happens when James Bond is locked in a form of transport with a lady for 15 minutes. I was not at all happy with that. How different, Paul, do you think the London opening ceremony would be if it was done now, post-Brexit? Would it be?
I think Eric Bristow lighting the flame would be quite a novel idea.
Yeah.
It would be very different,
like a
wouldn't
UKIP rally, would it, yeah. Rather than this expression of a tolerant, open nation.
Doing a tea dance. Remember Paul McCartney singing Get Back to Where You Once Belonged? It would be very different. That's the only opening ceremony I've ever watched from start to finish.
Maybe they actually not let anyone else into the opening ceremony except the UK.
You'd have 1,000 school children making the shape of a giant middle finger.
if we're all being honest, Turkey not let in. If we're all being honest with ourselves, we don't care, do we? We only cared about Britain because it was us.
It was undoubtedly brilliant for us. I'm not sure the rest of the world necessarily got all the references.
Certainly my relatives didn't understand what on earth that ceremony was about. Quintessentially British.
Yeah. It didn't involve lots of, turning up around the world and stealing all their natural resources and artefacts for our museums. Well, I mean, it's obviously you can't express everything in 2 hours.
But I know that in Brazil it's one of the things they've had to cut back on. So they obviously, they've had been in economic turmoil, almost ever since they won this bid, where, they won it at a time when they just discovered these huge oil reserves offshore. It was a brick nation. It was the coming power. And then very shortly afterwards, things went south. And so they've been cutting back ever since. So it may be that it's one carnival person, I
could just put up the goals from Brazil's 1982 volleyball. World Cup campaign.
Pele will undoubtedly be involved somewhere on the line. I think that's a very, very safe bet.
What I've heard is that a giant hole is going to open in the middle of the stadium, and 1,000 children dressed as dollar bills are going to be sucked down into a special vortex.
As giant syringes cavort around the exterior, yeah.
But no, I'm not convinced I'm going to be watching it. It's Friday night. I've got other things to be doing.
I do. I love an opening ceremony. Even a bad opening ceremony, I enjoy.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? That'd be great if it all messes up.
Was it in Seoul where they basically roasted some doves or something?
Yeah. Seoul, they roasted the doves. At Vancouver Winter Olympics, the whole thing sort of failed to open and it all went a bit wrong. In some ways, it's more entertaining if it goes wrong, and except when it's ours, of course. My favourite memory of the London opening ceremony was the dress rehearsal a few days before, where they sort of let us in so we could get an idea of what it was going to be like, so we could file on deadline, and so the next day's papers would have some coverage of the opening ceremony. But I sat next to the guy from the Mail who just, as it went on, then the NHS bit came up, and then he's getting more and more angry, and he just kept muttering, "Dacre's not going to like this, Dacre's not going to like this." And then obviously, lo and behold, on a Saturday, it was a triumph, and kind of the Mail fell into line with everyone else.
I mean, given what we now know about the direction that Britain's taken, I think Danny Boyle could have pushed it a bit further. We could have had Jeremy Corbyn lighting the flame, or Tony Benn, I don't know. We now know that was the last hurrah for liberal multicultural Britain.
And the way those industrial chimneys went up, that was that was really making the Industrial Revolution look like a piece of piss, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Well, building regulations were different in those days. So four years on from from London. There's a lot of talk about the legacy of is it discernible, or is it just a kind of glow of fond memories?
I think it's basically the latter. I mean, I could bore on about this for hours, but you know, the problem with the legacy was that so much was loaded onto it. I mean, basically, they claimed to have that Olympic legacy for almost everything to justify this £9 billion they'd spent. If they'd been a bit more defined in what they were hoping to get out of it, I think they might have been able to argue more successfully for what it had achieved. I mean, I think if you go to East London, if you go to the park, clearly that has been redeveloped. Whether it's been redeveloped for the benefit of the local people or for the people who are now living in those flats and working in Canary Wharf is another question, but that park looks better. I think the bit I always had the most problem with was the sort of sports participation legacy, that somehow by hosting this event we'd inspire loads of kids to play more sport. That was clearly never going to be true. It was never true for any previous Olympics, and the only way you're going to do that is by building more leisure centres and kind of, you know, and spending yes. the money on grassroots
and
sport,
not flogging off school playing fields
exactly and all yeah. that stuff. So I mean, that was the bit I always had most trouble with. But I think also kind of the post-Brexit thing is interesting, because one of the stated aims of it was to kind of rebrand Britain in the eyes of the world, that we weren't only going to be about Big Ben and, you know, and cups of tea and London buses, but we were a sort of vibrant, creative, outward-looking nation. And that kind of worked for about 2-3 years, and we seem to have rode back
two,
on that.
2-3 weeks.
Rode back a little bit on that more recently.
In terms of participation, though, because I think the stats show that participation's going down. In many ways, we could look at this as a very positive legacy, I think, in the same way that selling off all the school playing fields, I think, has been great for British sport. I mean, it might have led to an obesity epidemic amongst our young people. Let's look at medal hauls, which is what sport is all about. Beijing, London, Britain's best ever Olympic medal hauls, from generations of children who grew up under, you know, in the 1980s, 1990s, when the Conservatives were sold off the playing fields, carried on under Labour, and yet turns out that allowing all children access to sport was just allowing the shit ones to get in the way of the ones who might be good. So if we really want London to have a proper, genuine, lasting legacy on the Olympic medals table, we need to further cut back on children's participation.
Yeah, on that basis, we should let nobody do sport, yeah. But we should trawl the nation's primary schools for the ones who are tall enough to do rowing or whatever else, yeah. Just hothouse.
Well,
them,
and also you say that, yeah. But there's an element of truth in your biting satire, isn't there? Because if there is a legacy, the legacy is that we're still good at elite sports. The people who have access to being good at sport have still got access to being good at sport. And we're going to turn up to Rio far more like the London team than the Atlanta team in 1996.
Well, the one thing it did do, London, absolutely, was that it convinced governments that it's worth spending public money on elite sports. So basically, you know, that was a long battle for a long time, that we should have this national lottery and that we should spend the money from the national lottery on elite sportsmen and women. And I think, you know, the success of that, and obviously the glow for politicians that resulted from that, persuaded them that, yes, £250 million every 4 years is a worthwhile investment in winning these medals.
I mean, get 15 golds, that's great. I mean, we're never going to get 27. It's just,
I mean, they were a bit stupid. They came out, were they stupid or were they clever? I mean, they came out straight after London and said, we're going to win more medals in more sports than we did in London, which was never going to happen.
No.
But they made that promise, and now they've had to row back on that a bit and say, well, we're going to win more than we did in Beijing, and that is probably achievable. And if they do that, that'll be extraordinary.
But if they don't do that, anything over 10 is far beyond what any of us live. I mean, in my lifetime, I can't remember 72, but there was, what, 4 in 74, 5 in 76, 5 in 80, 5 in 84, 5 in 88, 5 in 92, 1 in 96. And then it was 2000 in Sydney that the comeback began. Mm. And
which coincides with lottery funding.
Yeah, 97 was when lottery started.
But I think, I've been perusing the betting for a lot of events.
I know that in one of the sailing events, a floating turd is currently second favourite.
Behind a dead dog.
London, I don't know what you think of the stadium legacy. There was all this talk about it not becoming a white elephant. And after so many modern Olympics now, there are now more white elephants than African elephants left in the world, I think. And I guess if I had a pound for every time I've heard someone say from a former Olympic host city, what, you're saying we don't need a 90,000-seat athletic stadium? Karen Brady from West Ham said this: what on earth do people want, a derelict site like the Athens Olympic Stadium? Well, I don't know if she's clearly never been to Athens. That's clearly exactly what Athens wants. A derelict site to how they make money. Yes. They've just got to give it a couple of thousand years. Yeah. Or she mentioned the Birdcage Stadium in Beijing, which is now apparently a Segway track. Now, if you'd told the people of London you can have a 24/7, 365 Segway track, we would have spent twice the amount of money.
They'd be all up for that, yeah. But yeah, the Bird's Nest is indeed a Segway track. Although when I went there for the World Athletics Championships, I did try to see if I could book a Segway ride, and that was the only time they weren't doing, unfortunately, Segway rides around the stadium. But so yeah, £700 million you've ended up spending on that stadium, and you go to that stadium, and it's a nice stadium, but it's not a £700 million stadium. I mean, all the mistakes that were made long before the Olympics in the planning. I mean, they could have easily planned to have an athletic stadium that converted into a football stadium. It would have cost a lot less, but there's, you know, for all kinds of political reasons, and because they were so scared of ending up with another sort of Wembley Millennium Dome fiasco on their hands, they were more keen to get on and start building than to worry about what was going to come afterwards.
And it has secondary knock-on effects for the economy as well, because now it's a football stadium. I think West Ham have sold, 50,000 season tickets? That's at least 50,000 pairs of high-quality binoculars that people are going to need. Yeah, those seats are a bloody long
way.
That's
a new shop in Westfield
pitch.
purely selling binoculars. That's right.
Me. Unused days, charge people £10 to get in and pay Nintendo to hide Pokemon all around the stadium. that's the way to get people in there, as far as I can tell.
Yes.
Coming to you live from the Sporter Cabin.
Now, Paul, you are renowned as one of the greatest quizzes this country's ever produced.
I had no idea.
Let's talk it up. Massive athletics fan. I'm now going to put you through your paces athletics quiz. There are 366 members of Team GB heading to Rio, which is the biggest that we've sent to an away Olympic since Barcelona in 1992. So can you tell me, Paul Sinha, renowned quizzer, every single one of the 371 British Olympians who went to Barcelona, starting now?
Well, let's start with athletics. 100 metres. The winner was Linford Christie. So, and how I remember who was the other athlete is he was massively athletic, MA. So that's Marcus Adam.
Good.
200 metres was, there was John Regis as well as Christie and Adam.
That's 368.
400 metres, a mixed bag of results. David Grindley reached the final, I think, and came sixth.
Right.
Poor old Derek Redmond had to be hauled off the track by his dad,
yep,
so to speak. Jill Hunter and Andrea Wallace.
Excellent.
That was the women's 10,000. 400 hurdles, obviously, the great Sally Gunn, all won gold, beating Sandra Farmer-Patrick. And Gary Richican, I think.
Yep.
Half Sri Lankan, half Indian, if I remember right. And Louise Fraser.
Very good.
The 10K walk, everyone remembers that one. That was Betty Swarovski. Fencing. Moving on to fencing. The men's foil. Jonathan Davis, Bill Gosby, and Donnie McKenzie. How many have I got?
You're 214, Paul, keep going.
Oh, right, hockey. Bit of disappointment after the glory of 1988, but did you do a full squad or just a side 11?
Oh, a full squad, Paul.
We'll start with women. Thompson, Morgan, Ailis, Brown, Neville, no relation, Atkins, Dixon,
Fraser. I think we only have one wrestler in Barcelona. It was in the 68 category or KG category or less. I think it was Callum McNeil.
That's it. That's your complete list?
I think so.
You missed out Deborah Southwick in the rhythmic gymnastics.
Oh!
Loser! Loser! Okay, well, that brings us to the end. Owen, have a great time. By the time anyone listens to this, you will already be having a...
Oh, well, he was smothered
great,
in DEET, yes.
DEET, and, playing, wearing bikinis on Copacabana Beach. Actually, standard Guardian issue.
Indeed.
Kit. Thanks very much for joining us. Paul, thanks again, and have a good Olympics on your sofa. That's,
I will do. I'm going to make absolutely sure of that. Domino's Pizza are in for a big windfall.
Thanks very much for listening. Do come and see me in Edinburgh if you're listening to this in August. I'm at the stand 3:40 p.m. every day talking about the world and stuff. Until next week, goodbye!